I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Pocalimp podcast. I'm Rick Henderson, and this week we'll be looking at Qualcomm's latest Snapdragon Summit and the hardware it announced during the two-day event. We'll also be interviewing the development CTO of the BMW Group, Frank Weber, about the BMW i7 and electric and autonomous driving in general. And we'll review the Canon EOS R7, its latest APS-C mirrorless camera, hoping to bridge the gap between convenience and picture quality. But now, back to Qualcomm and its Snapdragon Summit. Joining me is editor of Pocketlink, Chris Hall, who can explain a bit more about it. First up, Chris, what is the Snapdragon Summit?
It's a strange name for something that's really quite technical. Snapdragon Summit is an annual conference or congress that is held by Qualcomm, where it shows off products within its Snapdragon portfolio. So this is mostly consumer stuff, which is why we get interested in it and why lots of people are interested in it, because Qualcomm will announce all of these Snapdragon products, which will then go on to power a range of smartphones, laptops, and other devices over the coming year.
It doesn't just show mobile processors, although its biggest announcement this year, obviously, was the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2 CPU.
Yeah, that's right. And anybody who's been following smartphones for a while will know that Snapdragon has been at the heart of many of them and will be at the heart of many of them for the future. And the Snapdragon 8 series is really their top of the line. It used to be called the 800 series, and they shuffled the naming around with the last generation. So we're now on Snapdragon 8 Gen 2. And as you can imagine, these kind of developments are slightly incremental. So they don't really change the game with every step. They create new efficiencies. They put in improvements in specific places. So you'll see that you have better graphics performance and faster computing performance. And all of this will happen with greater efficiency. So the long and short of it is next generation of devices end up having more power and lower battery life demands, which is exactly what everybody's looking for.
And basically, when can we start to see the products of Qualcomm's labours in consumer hands?
Well, the interesting thing about Snapdragon Summit in 2022 is that it's been brought forward by a month. And so I think that we're going to be seeing products before the end of the year. Now, previously, this new hardware would be announced, and then it would probably be January or February before anything new came out. But making it known to the public a little bit earlier seems to be feeding into the line. And I suspect that we'll be seeing announcements from brands like Oppo or Xiaomi, because Snapdragon hardware is very, very popular in the Chinese market. And often the manufacturers over in China make announcements before Christmas. You know, so there'll be devices that they launch in China, which may not come out in the rest of the world until February or March next year. But yeah, we'll definitely start to see these devices appearing within weeks, I would imagine.
Qualcomm is kind of spreading its wings and has always sort of provided concept technologies at these summits. But it's kind of spreading its wings even further at the moment, because there's an awful lot of mobile manufacturers creating their own chipsets now, aren't there?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's part of the exercise here, is to make people say, I want a Snapdragon branded device, because you're right, there are lots of other people who are playing in this game. And some of them are developing their own hardware and branding it as their own hardware. Lots of people are developing their own branded hardware, but are all using exactly the same core to it. Qualcomm is obviously keen to make sure that they still have a huge market in mobile devices. And yeah, so they want to make sure that it's appealing, but also that they are powering a full range of different types of devices. And this really sees Qualcomm mirroring the same sort of changes that we saw over at Apple, where Apple was developing its own hardware and then moved that over to its laptops when it started talking about Apple Silicon. And that's something that has been going on in the background in the industry for a while. And it's now starting to become more evolved and more developed. So there are Snapdragon products that power laptops as well. They're not as widely used as Apple's devices. Many sort of Windows laptops are still be running on Intel, but there is a growing demand for the advantages that come with using Snapdragon hardware. The integrated 5G, for example, enhanced battery life and that kind of thing.
I mean, the other thing that people might not realise about Qualcomm is it also is behind Aptx, the Bluetooth wireless music audio standard, which allows you to stream almost lossless audio to different devices. And there were quite a few big announcements here about Snapdragon Sound. But we need to start seeing it come into headphones, really, because we haven't actually seen it.
Yeah, this is an interesting shift in the way that Qualcomm is positioning itself. As it's this, as you said, it kind of sits on the technology between Aptx and all the variants of it, Aptx HD and adaptive and so on. And audio people have been talking about Aptx for a long time because of the ability to listen to higher quality wireless music. Qualcomm wrapped it up into a package called Snapdragon Sound, and the aim here is really to include it with their hardware, so that if you have a Snapdragon 8 Gen 2 device, it may well offer Snapdragon sounds as well. In the olden days, it would have just said, well, Aptx codecs are supported natively. So part of it is a rebranding exercise as they redevelop this stuff. There aren't many manufacturers at the moment, however, who talk about Snapdragon sound. I saw a set of headphones from Master and Dynamic that talked about Snapdragon sound, but there are lots of manufacturers who still talk about Aptx and the various, and the various versions of that. So it kind of feels as though Qualcomm is pushing Snapdragon sound in one direction. We're waiting to see if the rest of the market leaps on board, because ultimately, if you make a set of headphones, you want to support as many codecs as you can, as you can. So that may be Aptx. LDAC from Sony is another one. And as there is greater data available for music downloads and streaming, we're seeing higher quality music services and a greater demand for, better quality audio through these headphones. So there's a bit of a battle of the codecs going on. Some of this will purely come down to how much of a license fee a particular headphone manufacturer would have to pay to the person who provided the codec. This is all still a work in progress, but through the next year, we'll probably see more devices and more headphones that are launching using Snapdragon Sound as a brand to try and convince you to pair up a particular phone with a particular brand of headphones, for example.
The other area that at this Snapdragon Summit that you could see Qualcomm really moving into is AR, and it had a new chipset which allows AR to become a little bit more as we'd expect in science fiction movies.
Yeah, Qualcomm has been producing hardware for VR headsets and demoing concept versions for many years before anybody was really thinking about it in sensible terms. And we're now moving towards a point where people are saying, well, this is a reality now. And one of the big barriers has always been form factor. And having lighter hardware that needs less power to run it is really important, because you don't want to be wearing a massive battery on your head if you're trying to wear a pair of AR glasses. So the idea here is to make sure that you can have all of the data rates so that you can have great connectivity to be able to process all of the information, as well as have this running without needing a lot of power, so that you can wear these glasses and walk around the place and be untethered from your phone and all the rest of it. The most important thing here really is going to be about the people who take this hardware and develop it. And there are lots of people saying that they're interested, from the usual suspects like Xiaomi and Lenovo. But for me personally, I was more interested in the messages coming out of Niantic, who is behind Pokemon Go. Because Pokemon Go, as far as I'm concerned, is the most significant augmented reality event that's lasted for how many years? 6 years now, I think Pokemon Go has been around and is still hugely popular. And that really changed the message and said, this is something you could actually do. So if we can see a development where you could have Pokemon Go in a slim pair of glasses to augment reality as you see it without having to use your phone all the time to view the world, then that's going to be a major development. And importantly, it would be a massive hook for actual real consumers, for customers, to say to people, go out and buy this because here's something that's actually really clever.
So I think the final word will be, we should see the smartphones from the end of the year, but are we expecting to see any of Qualcomm's other technologies emerging onto the market in 2023?
Certainly. I don't think they would be showing this stuff off if they didn't have every intention of having it out there on the market. I think the best time to look forward to is February, March 2023 around Mobile World Congress. That's where we expect a lot of devices will be made. And throughout the year, these things will probably be launched. So I would say that by summer next year, we'll probably have some slim AR glasses that will look pretty cool and have plenty of functionality.
Now to BMW and an interview with the company's chief technology officer and member of BMW AG's board of management, Frank Weber. Chris recently took a drive with him in the new BMW i7 around the streets of Palm Springs, where they talked about the car, the company, and the future of motoring in general. He started by asking why BMW decided to launch the new 7 Series with a complete range of powertrains.
When you look at the next 10 years, you see, depending on markets, within markets, depending on countries' readiness for electric propulsion, if there is a strong interest in electric propulsion, but at the same time, there is an interest in combustion engines. If you take the US, for example, California is a wonderful example. There are people who are looking now forward to getting a new 7 Series with an 8-cylinder. And then there are people here that say, oh, a new 7 Series needs to be electric, and it can only be electric. And since this is true in almost all markets, we decided and said we want to have the best combustion engines, the best plug-in hybrids, and we want to have the best possible battery electric vehicle for the 7 Series, especially for this car.
So whichever 7 Series you buy, you'll get in a proper 7 Series and all of the choices.
You will see the V8 later. You will see, by the way, I can give you a diesel 7 Series. I can give you one of the plug-in hybrids where the electric drive has as much torque as a 6-cylinder. So I can give you whatever propulsion system you want. The only thing I'm telling my team is I want that the best solution comes from us.
So are there any compromises in the platform because of that flexibility that you have?
There is no compromise. There is no compromise. You have, at the end, a little bit more height because you have to accommodate the batteries. You saw that in the workshop this morning.
Yeah.
To accommodate this battery, at the end, we have 35 millimeters more in height than our competitor that has no BEV capability. Mm-hmm. So this is the delta. I think the discussion around purpose-built architectures and flexible architectures, I think we proved already with the i4. I think this is not such a fundamental discussion like some people say. If you are not purpose-built, actually, your vehicle cannot work.
So what's it been like for you witnessing the transition from combustion to electrification?
For me, this has a very high attraction. The future is electric. And I think what we are focusing on is how do we get to this fully electric future, because this is not trivial at all. This is not just about now providing some electric vehicles and the rest will come. I used to call this, we have to prepare our industry and the industries around us for BEV readiness. And this BEV economy requires sufficient charging. It requires green raw materials in every world region. It requires green electricity for producing cells, green electricity for driving cars, and it needs full circularity on the precious raw materials you have within battery cells. So what you always have to think about is, are we ready in every country? And you come from the UK.
The UK, yeah.
And where we sometimes ask ourselves, you have the impression that the ambition, the political ambition, is not in line with what is really feasible within that industry.
Sure.
and therefore, I have to admit, you will see it later in the drive, when you take the 7 Series as one example, and see how the i7 now is performing. What you will observe, and this is not just on the Coach Rover side, you will experience it yourself. Since you have that high mass battery, we talk about almost 700 kilograms of battery mass sitting in the center of the car. What this is doing is the car is getting with regard to the wheel mass and the rest of the vehicle, the unsprung mass is very low in comparison to the rest, and suddenly you not only have a quiet propulsion system, you have in your whole vehicle, it's a very calm setup. So it's therefore I say having a fantastic battery electric version and at the same time a combustion engine is for me no personal conflict at all. I think we have to help consumers into this electric world. Not everybody, we have to say, is ready for fully electric. But yeah, the people who are ready, they can take now a 7 Series and say, I can use this car like I used my other car. Yesterday, I mentioned it briefly. I'm driving now for 5,500 kilometers. 5,500. Since July with my 7 Series. And I had a consumption average over the 5,500 of 20.6 kilowatt hours. 100, which is, I think, an excellent result. And so I think many people will love exactly this electric version.
Yeah.
And there will be others who say, I still love what I'm used to.
So. Yeah, sure. So I should just say that we are sitting in the BMW i7 driving through Palm Springs at the moment. Very quiet, very refined so far. What is your favorite piece of technology in the car?
A car is never a single piece of technology. What I love about it is how we achieve from generation to generation always an improvement. And it's the whole thing that is improving. In a 7 Series, you expect from all areas, driving dynamics, all the comfort that the car has, digital performance. And then there are, you might say, theater mode is not a gimmick. For people that are sitting in the rear say, I have never had such an experience. And when you take all of this together, I think it is the combination of those things,
sure,
that make a top-end product like the 7 Series so attractive.
So just to illustrate this for people listening, with a press of a couple of buttons, we've just deployed a theatre in the rear of the car, and I'm now having a massage in the front seat. So one of the manufacturers who's done putting a lot of work to create a seamless experience for their users is Tesla. And Tesla is one of Tesla's strongest points is the supercharger network.
Yeah.
What is BMW doing to make that experience, the charging experience on the road, as smooth as it is a Tesla supercharging?
When you look at since we are talking Europe now as an example, we have Ionity. Ionity is a multi-OEM charging network that has as many high power chargers as Tesla has. In addition, we are cooperating with other companies to have even more charging. So when you look at the comparisons of what you can do with a BMW charging card, you have more access points than anybody else. And they all work, and you get, also when it comes to the tariffs and everything, I think our system is performing is performing really well. What we are watching very carefully is when you have high power chargers and you have multiple outlets at this single charger location, you observe with the manufacturer that you have just mentioned that when they have multiple vehicles at this high power charger, then you have only very little power available for the individual car. And so when you come to an Ionity location where you have 6 or 8 individual charging points, you can see that you can have 6 or 8 vehicles also charged at the same high level of 200, 300 kilowatts at this location. This is how we are designing it. And you are absolutely right. Charging is the number one convenience factor for people. You can dissatisfy or satisfy people with charging, but I think I would say with Ionity and the options we have in here, we are well positioned. So if you look at the offer we have in here, just get an idea. And this would be our charging options that our charging card gives you access to.
So we've just pulled onto the highway, freeway, motorway, autobahn. Tell me something about taking hands-free driving to the next level.
Yeah, what we have, level 2 functions where the driver is still responsible. You can nevertheless enhance your feeling of automation a lot. So when you look at the system capabilities that we have with some additional sensing, we have enhanced the capabilities a lot.
So this will keep you in position in the lane, follow the curves of the road, yep, avoid traffic. Will it change lanes for you?
We don't have automatic lane change.
Okay.
Yes.
And this is currently legal in the US and Canada?
Is legal in the US and China.
And China
and Europe. We are working with the regulators intensively because those functions here give consumers, for the relative cost of such a system, a lot of benefit. And since the European regulators very much focused on level 3 systems, it's not that they forgot it, but actually looking at how level 2 systems can be enhanced, they ignored it for a little bit of time. So we are currently optimistic that we will have very soon the possibility to take that system that you see in here, that we will be able to do this also in Europe.
Fantastic.
Yeah, because I think this is something people are really looking forward to.
And so to our review, and I'm now joined by PocketLink contributing editor Luke Baker, who has been testing the Canon EOS R7 flagship mirrorless camera. Canon has historically been slow to embrace the rise of the hybrid, but in the R7 it has an APS-C option that looks great on paper. Does that ring as true in the field though, Luke?
Yeah, so I spent about a week with the Canon R7, and it's quite an impressive body. Specs-wise, there's a lot going for it. It has a much improved autofocus system. It's got in-body image stabilization. And it's all quite good. But the problem is there's not many lenses that are... Well, at the moment, there's 2 lenses that are specifically designed for APS-C on the RF mount, which is what the R7 and R10 now use. So that leaves you with a lot of very, very expensive lens options that you can't make the most of with the camera, and it puts it in a very strange middle ground. I think if they release more appealing lenses, then it'll be a really good pick for a lot of people. But at the moment, like I said, there's 2. Neither of them are very exciting lenses. They're quite slow zoom lenses. It's a hard one to recommend when there's so many other great APS-C options with boatloads of lenses. But if Canon continue to support the system and build out that lens portfolio, then it could be amazing. So yeah, very, very strange one.
I mean, naturally, it's I think it has recently announced a full frame option as well, of a different model, but in mirrorless. So is there still a market for Canon in the APS-C arena?
Well, that is what was lacking. So it's understandable that they've released some APS-C bodies. But the big change is that the APS-C bodies used to be with the M mount, or the EF on DSLR. And now they've moved it to the same mount as the full frame cameras, which is RF mount. Which in theory is a good thing. If you already own a lot of that glass, you can use it across, but because it's designed for full frame, it's large, it's heavy, it's expensive, and it doesn't really make sense on an APS-C camera. That's where they're at.
Looking back at the actual camera itself, about the body, I mean, that's obviously a pitfall, but this is a new venture for them. So what's the size like? What's it like to hold?
It's quite compact, but still quite weighty. It's a lot like the 7D from years back. It's kind of...
The old DSLR, yeah.
Yeah. Surprisingly, it's not much smaller being mirrorless, and that seems to be the case with Sony and everyone, really. Like, originally, everyone thought mirrorless bodies were going to be really small, but then they started adding in image stabilization and everything, and they've kind of bulked back up to the exact same size that they used to be. But it's very ergonomic. It's a classic kind of Canon look. The one thing that's interesting is they've moved the wheel on the rear of the camera where you normally select the ISO. That's higher up on this model, and this is the only model where it's moved. I found it a little bit too close to my face when I was taking photos. It was a bit strange to get used to. It worked fine, but it's one of those that where you just think, I don't really know why they've changed this, but they just want to try something different. Why not, I suppose? But yeah.
Can you see their mirrorless cameras actually eventually replacing the full frame? DSLRs. Because I own both a Canon DSLR, the 5D Mark III, which still, I swear, is one of the greatest cameras ever made. But also an EOS M original mirrorless camera. And the reason why I bought that is because it's a complementary camera. It actually fits in a bag. I can just chuck it in a bag. I can use that at any time, whereas the 5D is a monster. It seems with, like you say, the EOS R7 is a little bit more chunky, a little bit more weighty than that. So is it a really replacement for a DSLR?
I think it just seems to be the way the industry is going. Obviously, there's something to be said for DSLRs. It's very nice, that shutter click. You can't really replicate that without the mirror moving out of the way and everything. And it's nice to actually look through the prism and see through the lens. But there's so many advantages to going mirrorless, especially in the speed, burst speed, and actually being able to see your exposure properly through the EVF rather than kind of guessing what the final output's going to look like. It does seem pretty much everyone's going all in on mirrorless. And Canon was the big holdout, but I mean, I don't know the last time they released a DSLR. It's all been mirrorless lately. So it does seem to be the way of things.
I suppose the last thing my last question is, what else does it have? Is there a reason to buy it if you are sort of like willing to wait for those lenses?
Yeah, I'd say if you already own an R-series camera, you've already got RF glass that you're happy with, then the R7 makes sense as a companion camera, especially for wildlife. The APS-C crop lets you get closer. It's much faster than any of the full-frame cameras in terms of burst speed. And it's got some high-speed video options as well, which are less common on the full-frame ones. So, Yeah, I think that kind of, if you've already invested in the glass, then the price of it doesn't matter so much because you already own it. And then it does have a use then. It's just if you're looking for an APS-C camera, it's a weird choice until they make APS-C specific glass that's more appealing.
Am I right in thinking it's around 1,200?
300, I think. Yeah. Yeah, about that. Yeah, so 1349.
It's fairly reasonably priced for a flagship camera.
Yeah, it is. It is a good price. When you compare to, I think Fujifilm's the main competitor in terms of APS-C bodies. Pretty much everything is more expensive, especially if you want equivalent specs. You're looking at least £500 more, probably more than that. So yeah, one of the things that is appealing is that it's on the low end of pricing. It is quite well priced.
And that's it for another Pocket Limp podcast. I've been Rick Henderson, and I'll be returning soon with a new episode where we'll bring you the latest from the world of tech. In the meantime, please rate us on the podcast platform of your choice and or let us know what you think of the podcast on Instagram at pocketlint.com, all one word, and Twitter at pocketlint, no hyphen. Until next time, tatty bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.